Okay, Shalom Rav, Larav Agon, a Gadol Amforz, Karugas Habosem. Rav Avraham. Oh, that's typical.
Read his English translation.
Yeah, it's whatever. Like, it's actually gonna. This English translation is gonna. My English translation is gonna go to. It's for a book that's being published by Princeton University Press, so it'll, you know. I figured they would want me to translate actually everything, right? And I just, you know, so whatever. Abundant peace to the great and brilliant rabbi, eminent like a fragrant flower bed. Whatever. Okay. So Avdekak Glogau. Okay. So he's the Avbezdin of Glogau. Today, Glogau, Poland. Gross Glogau in Germany, which is. Pretty sure it's in, it's in the part of Poland which was once Germany, which would mean Silesia, right? Western Poland. That's who he's writing to. So somebody in the German sphere of influence. Okay, does he give us a date here? The date, let's take a look at the date. The date's usually at the end, or often at the end. Yeah, 5570, that's 1810. Okay, oh, look at that. The 21st day of Adar Rishon. I guess we're about a month off.
He's writing about in 1810. Pesach, so it's not such a coincidence.
Well, it's a month and a half before Pesach. It's almost 2 months before Pesach, because there's an Adar Rishon that year.
He's got a load of peanuts, and he doesn't want to have to get rid of them.
Yeah. It's actually, like, they use this as the dating, they actually use it as a halachic makor, right? That there's one tshuva in which the Chasam Sofer signs it. It's in Adar Rishon, and he says, whatever date of Adar Rishon or Aleph Adar Rishon, shenichnasim bo l'simcha. Right? So people like the way that he signed the letter. People use it as a like there's a whole machlok as to whether or not mishenichnas Adar Marvin b'simcha applies only to Adar Sheni or is it even Adar Rishon. So they use like that epigram of the Chasam Sofer to prove that. It's even Adar Rishon. I'll take it. Whatever. Any excuse to drink. Okay. So, no michtavo hiir mul ever panaiva amarti ashrei hador shagdolim omdim peretz l'chol koshel. Right? It's great that you're standing in the breach. What breach? We don't know yet. But, you know, we see what's coming. L'chol koshel yeshem elokim imo v'yal v'yazreu al derech kvod shmo gadol v'asher Invitanu to harabani la sototi snif la arayot. Right? So he's speaking in humility here. The truth of the matter is, 1810. Chasam Sofer is just hitting his stride. He became the Rav of Pressburg, which is where he really reached the peak of his eminence, in 1806. In 1810, he's still at the beginning of his. He's still at the beginning of his tenure there. Thank you. And he's really but you see people are already starting to write him shilohs and tshuvos from fairly far away from Glogau. Meaning today, whatever, it's probably I don't know less than a 5-hour drive. Then probably a little bit more complicated. But you'll see that you're dealing with international issues here. You're dealing with real international issues.
When did the reform movement start?
So there's no moment that you can point to that talks about the beginning of the reform movement, but the publication of Ela Divrei HaBrit, right? Ela Divrei HaBrit was a pamphlet to which the Chatam Sofer contributed, that was published in reaction to it was three isurim. I have a copy of it here. Asur l'shanot b'seder tefillah hanehuga b'Yisrael. You can't change the seder min birchot ha-shachar ad achar aleinu l'shabeach. U'mikol shekein she'ein ligroa mimenu. Okay? Meaning, seder freezes. Asur l'hitpalel seder tefillah halaz b'lashon acher chutz milashon ha-kodesh. Can't daven in any other language. V'chol tefillah hanidpeset shelo ketikuna v'shelo kemin hagenu hi psulav asur lehitpalel mitocha, can't daven from such a sitter, and asur lenagen v'beit ha-kneset v'shum kli shir v'shabat u'v'yom tov afilu eno yisrael afilu al yedei Eino Yisrael. Okay, so you know that's you can't have Gayim playing music in your shuls on Shabbos. So all of these three things, like there, you know, there are halachic justifications for all of them, right? There are halachic reasons for all of them, but it was a reaction against, like you have this consolidation of this reaction against the nascent reform movement. This was published in the city of Hamburg, or the nearby city of Altona, in Tafkuf Ein Tet, right? So that's 1819.
Okay.
So
it was that early.
Between 1810 and 1820 is when congregations began to open. Season Hamburg, Dolan.
Yeah, Hamburg is the first. This is against Hamburg.
That's interesting. I didn't realize it was that early before.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so here again, like you're talking about, and within the text, you see that there are individuals who are starting to say much more radical things, meaning within the Reform movement, right? Like today, we would say that, like, okay, if somebody doesn't read Hebrew, that they can daven out of a siddur that's in a different language. It's, you know, it's like you sometimes even want to encourage it, right? You know, like we're the Kiruv generation. But this sort of thing where you know, like you're coming out, this strong reaction against using a siddur in a language other than Hebrew, you know, this was these were like the first shots fired.
He's talking about individuals, he's saying like the whole shul is using.
Yes,
German
congregations.
Siddur.
Correct. Yeah, there's a difference between congregation, but like, you know, even there, you see that it's a reaction against a movement. It's not a reaction against this psak or that psak, right? Because each one, like, you know, for an individual to, you know, to pray in a different language is acceptable. Hmm. If somebody doesn't read Hebrew, they can pray in any language. It's Mishnayos talk about it. You know, but here, when you turn it into a, you know, this is what we do in this synagogue, that warrants a strong response. But you see that initially you're talking about a movement that's tinkering around the edges. Now, there were some that were taking out references to Yerushalayim, that were taking out references to... all kinds of stuff. They were calling their shuls temples, right? They were against, the reaction was very against the idea of calling a shul a temple. It's saying, like, we only have one temple. It's in Jerusalem. It's not in Hamburg or Berlin. That's Eile Divrei HaBrit, different work, different, meaning that's like, and it's a foundational document in the coalescing of the crystallization of Orthodox response to Reform. And there are some that would argue that Orthodoxy itself is a response to Reform, right? That Orthodoxy is born during this decade, right, between 1810 and 1820. Because Orthodoxy is a new thing. Before Orthodoxy, there was traditional society. And then after this, you know, after you have this, you know, movement toward Reform, you know, there's a movement toward, you can only talk about Orthodox, right? Orthodox as a reaction against other choices, right? A conscious decision to operate in a certain way rather than just the continuation of a traditional way of life. I don't think that's correct. Actually, I don't think that that's
This is maybe off base, but so am I, so it's okay. The mode of dress and grooming, or lack thereof, that you find from I don't know when. So maybe was it forever? Or was it also part of a reaction to the Reform to sort of go in the opposite direction from being groomed?
There's a famous picture from Slobodka Yeshiva, and they're all shaven,
yeah,
well-groomed. They look like any other modern, respectable person.
I think the answer to that question is it might depend when and where, but I don't think there was any conscious choice to like say like we're not going to groom ourselves. I mean, maybe there was. I don't know. Because we don't want to look like those guys. Like there was definitely movements to not change our mode of dress.
No, I was just wondering if for you know is it for centuries?
Right. If the reforms take showers,
always looked like they've had their hand on the Van de Graaff machine, or is it just a fairly recent thing that we're not going to conform to the notion of being presentable.
I think the Hasidim actually did it intentionally.
By the way, no, the whole issue of Shem Lashon Malbush, that we don't change our language, we don't change our names, and we don't change our mode of dress, really becomes a big thing in Hungary in the 1850s.
even though their dress, at least the dress of, that they have today, is Polish 19th century dress. It's not
earlier, right? Meaning, like, that's part of like what you know, what this definition of orthodoxy is, right? You have a traditional society where there is change, but it's really slow. It's long term. It's shaped by you know internal forces more than by external forces. Is replaced by a very reactionary that, like, if you're doing it one way, we're going to do it the other way. I don't think there was ever a takana, let's say. Like, Reform synagogue, Reform temples, the early Reform temples, one of the things they were known for was their decorum, right? Mm-hmm. Almost church-like. You sat in your pew and you didn't say a word. I don't think that there were any shuls, right, Orthodox shuls, that said, okay, everybody, we should now talk during davening.
It sure seems that way.
Right, it sure seems that way because, you know, shul fulfills a social function as, you know...
No, I was really asking about...
In addition to a religious function.
I was asking about the grooming.
Okay, because, right. No, I mean, not everything is reactionary. I mean, like, there are some scholars that they like to see in everything a reaction, right? Everything, you know, every Jewish development of the last 1,000 years is a reaction against Christianity or a reaction against this or a reaction against that. Whatever, I think everything has to be... studied upon itself. Orthodoxy is a moment in time. That's,
simplistic?
No, well, I don't think it's simplistic at all. I mean, that's Jacob Katz's claim, and he's anything but simplistic. I think there was something that very, very different happening then. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, in his, it was Katz, and then after him, primarily his student, Moshe Samet. But since then, I mean, I think that there's a new generation of scholars that are sort of trying to walk that back a little bit and trying to show how much real change was taking place in the 16th century, the 17th century, the early part of the 18th century, long before issues like reform came up. You know, to say that there was always a sort of dynamic and there was always a sort of reaction, right? And this was just the last, you know, one of the latest and one of the most schismatic, but okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. I think we're going to jump around in this one because it's... Right? He's asking, the Chasam Sofer has asked whether it's proper, that it's incorrect in the eyes of today's sages, right? We shouldn't learn from this, you know, disruption, this error. Okay. Okay. Vahani, right? These guys, he doesn't yet say who they are, right? We're in the first paragraph, the paragraph that begins Noam. Fourth line from the end of the paragraph, Hani ki yichidi dami. These guys, they're like yichidim, right? They're like a das yachid, right? Oh, sorry. In the previous, the ein yichidim yicholim lahatir, that if there's a gezeira, individuals can't be matir the gezeira, Hani ki yichidi damu. These guys, they're like yichidim, legabe kol medinos ashkenaz, right? With respect to all of the countries within Germany. Shekiblu aleihem mitchila, who were already mekabel on themselves, le'esor. To shiny, right? If it's actually life threatening, it's different. Okay. So that's his initial answer. Right? So he doesn't want to get involved. He wants to say they're like Yechidim, so whatever. He hasn't even said what the question is yet.
Okay.
It's Jesse. Okay. Hayom. His first reaction is like, yeah, it's not a good idea. But if there's like a real reason to say it's okay because there's a sakana, it's different. Use good judgment. Fine. Hayom he'iru einayim itam imrotav. Just now, I was brought to know odot consistoria de Medinas Westphalia. Right? the consistoire. Now, consistoire is not a German word.
Français.
That's right. It's a French word. Why, in the state of Westphalia, are they using a French word for like a...
Was Napoleon's...
Bingo. Napoleon. Napoleon's the answer. 1810, right? We're in the middle of the era of Napoleon. Napoleon is on his march through Europe, bringing all sorts of, you know, spreading the gospel of liberty, equality, fraternity, equal rights, etc. And that includes granting Jews civil rights that they never had before, right? And so in these states, right, in Westphalia, which is northwest Germany, close to the French border, you know, not, I don't think like Cologne and Dusseldorf and I don't think they're in Westphalia, but I think that they're like just barely not in Westphalia. It's that region. So you know what? So what did they say? Asher bikshu nafsham.
What's a consistoire?
Consistoire is like a governing rabbinic body, right? Like basically a rabbanut, right? It's an official body convened by the government to be the the Jewish leaders of that era.
Now this is not related to the Sanhedrin, right? Do he wanted to establish?
I don't know enough of the history. I think that they might be related. In fact, I think that the chief rabbi of Westphalia at this time, who made this takana, was a member of Napoleon's Sanhedrin. But again, I would have to drill a little bit deeper to get into that kind of stuff. I mean, I would have had to prepare more to get into that kind of stuff, that sort of stuff. Right. So the rabbis of Westphalia wanted to get rid of the Isser Kitnios b'Yom Tov Shol Pesach. And they were matir for themselves. Right. So they were matir. Maybe they know why. Right, we have to give them the benefit of the doubt. So the first thing he says is, right, you know, we have to give them the benefit of the doubt. We can't say that they're a bunch of rishoyim ahurim, in the words of Nachum Shtisel. Maybe they had a good reason. Maybe they saw that people would otherwise be eating chametz gomer, right, or that they were baking matzah in a way that was going to make it likely to become chametz. Yeshar latzis yidei chovas shimur karaoy, and they couldn't properly watch the matzahs kol kach. Well, kein bacharu harab miuto. So they opted for the lesser of two evils. Lahatir la'aniyeh Yisrael minim halalu, to let the poor people consume these, you know, these types of foods on Yom Tov, on Pesach. Kadesh yima'atu b'afiyas matzos, so they wouldn't have that many matzos. V'hi v'yum mishumarim mikol chimutz, right? And so there won't be any chametz. V'nucha lomar adaita t'hachi lo echmiru haga'onim harishonim. And you can say that the original sages who originally, you know, promulgated the Isser against kitnios, right, they never had this in mind. They weren't so machmir that, like, if it's kitnios versus chametz, that you should opt for chametz, right? Etc. And it goes, my moneyos. It could be that, you know, if there's a potential kilkul, right? Liesh levatel minhag. Meaning, if the whole idea of a takana is to keep people away from an avera, and then it turns out that the same enactment is causing people to sin more, you should be levatel the minhag. Okay.
What's the connection to Ani and Yisrael? It seems like he's saying that actually baking matzah itself is kind of, you're walking a fine line, and, you know, you're always on the verge of having it become chametz, and it's better to have as little matzah as possible because every matzah is potentially chametz. So what's the connection to Ani?
You buy from the discount matzah baker because that's all you can afford. It's more likely he's going to...
Yeah, I don't... Again,
matzah,
I think...
Matzah is more expensive when you say Ani and Yisrael. You know, matzah is more expensive than corn patties.
I don't know if Yoni's right, but I think that that's the kind of answer that it is. Meaning, there's something... For some reason, in the realia of the situation, that aniyim were more at risk of this,
It's also if you make matzah and it turns into hummus.
Yeah, I don't know.
You're poor, you're more likely to try to salvage it than toss it in there.
And it may not have had to do with matzah per se. It may have even had to do with all Pesach stuff. And I know, but I mean, it's bichlal. You know, you eat more than matzah on Pesach, or maybe they didn't, but the poor would have less of a choices of what to eat. And if they had to rely on so much matzah and it was hard to make sure that all of it would be good, then they would be, it would be a mishal to that.
Okay. Vimi tamazah, if that's their reasoning, tamazah asu kacha, yotha asu, then they did a good thing. Ella, shayalahem lahazir lasez, a kidney oz b'mayim rothim yad, you should have told them, take the kidney oz and throw them into boiling hot water right away, so that will prevent them from, you know, becoming chametz. Meaning, if you do that with regular grain,
right,
it prevents it from becoming chametz. If you take wheat and throw it into boiling water, then it doesn't become chametz later. By the way, in terms of the beer, there's a certain variety of beer that's specialized in Bamberg. They specialize in it, called Rausch beer. It's they roast the barley before they malt it. So, like, I'm wondering if, like, theoretically, if you roast the barley before, seriously, if you can make kosher Le Pesach beer, that's a $1 million idea right there.
You know, Pesach's only 8 days, and Jews are not known to be
seven.
There are like 800 firm Jews in the world that like beer.
Here,
yes,
right, but
still a $1 million idea.
That's right.
Hmm. All the hotels.
All the space up
programs. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fine. We're going to move on because it gets into the question of like whether or not we're not Bikim in Chalita. In, you know, in
wait, am I wrong that it sounds like he's being Malamed Tzvos, but not in a completely, in a slightly sarcastic manner?
I don't think he's being sarcastic.
Okay. He sounds like he's saying.
I think he's being diplomatic, but I don't think he's being sarcastic.
Maybe not sarcastic is the right word, but he doesn't. I don't think he believes that this is actually the reason. For a second, that this is why they did it. You consider just being
correct. That's what a limud zchus is.
Right.
A limud zchus is like, listen, these guys, these are the rabbis in Westphalia, right? I don't want to get up and, you know, step on their toes. Mm-hmm. You got to remember, like, Germany was not yet unified, so you had all kinds of principalities and duchies and provinces and whatnot that, you know.
And he probably didn't hold by the whole Rabbanut thing, Napoleon's Rabbanut anyway.
Oh, of course, that was no Napoleon Sanhedrin. Nobody held of it.
Right.
By
the way, is the use of halahu v'halan also a little bit of a dig?
No, halahu v'halan is just like a general thing. Like you know, it's.
I mean, but the real expression is halan v'halahu. Mm. So I'm saying by reversing it, is he?
I don't think so.
More to that than okay.
I don't think so. That is the beginning of his next paragraph. Halahu v'halan. Right. What they do in their town is their business. Right. Mm-hmm. That's not our issue, right? I could be Malamed Chus for them. I can't be Malamed Chus for us. Now, the thinking was that the way to be Matirit is through whatever, like Hataras Nedarim. Pashut She'en Lahatir Minim Halali, right? We can't. Lo Mabaya below Heter Petach V'charata De Pshita. Was it man? Right, that's a phrase from Nedarim. Man Safin. Right, who's so prominent, who's so important, who's so perfectly tailored to uproot this decree, right? This fixed practice that was established by Rabotzenu HaTzarfatim, right? By the French rabbis, with the Rishonim of Ashkenaz. I do want to skip around because
was this a practice in Poland also?
Kenyot, of course, Pan Ashkenazic minhag.
Right.
It actually begins in the first reference to it. Simcha Emanuel found, meaning published recently, a Shabbos HaGadol Drasha of the Bala Rokeach, Rabbi Elazar of Worms, from the early 1200s. That's the earliest reference to it, and it's also the earliest reason for it, which is that it gets, because all kitniot have chametz mixed in. And he, in a footnote, relates it to the question of crop rotation, that legumes and grains would have been, you know, planted in the same fields. And I think that, I mean, that has the ring of truth. It's what makes the most sense. Okay. So the entire discussion, right, paragraph after paragraph, is about whether or not one can abolish a takana, right? Whether or not you can do hataras nedarim, whether or not you can abolish a takana, and who has the power to do that. And he goes through different, you know, he goes through different possibilities. Do you need a bezdin hagadol? How, you know, how far did it spread? You know, if it didn't spread so far, then you can. But if it spread further,
yeah, is there a hierarchy of takanot in terms of their origins that they cancel them, be dependent upon their origin?
Yeah, he just says that in this case it doesn't practice, it doesn't work because it's pan Ashkenazic,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's the only way, even if you could find a reason to be moderate. Here, let's see if we can. Where is that? The only way that you can fire it, the only way that you could be matir it, is by gathering all or most of the chachamim from all of Ashkenaz, meaning all of those communities that accepted the decree from the beginning. it says they're all considered one city, right? Meaning the halacha talks about what can happen in one city, right? If one city accepts something, and how can that one city be matir? So the entire Ashkenaz is considered one city, and then he quotes the Pri Chadash, who has a whole kuntris on me. He quotes him positively, which is kind of surprising because in general the Pri Chadash is like an Ashkenazi whipping boy. The Ashkenazi poskim just love, you know, ripping into the Pri Chadash. It's like a sport. It's like a way to prove your Ashkenazi credentials. Well, the Pri Chadash says this, but I mean. Right. Okay. Skipping again. Right, he then quotes, right, there's a Gemara in Psachim about whether or not if one generation was mekabel something, can the next generation be get rid of it? The Yerushalmi in Psachim, which does not permit the people of Beit Sha'an to release their vow, and says why? So, and he answers that in a case where they had instituted a practice on their own, right, and it wasn't based on an explicit consensus, and it wasn't based on a takana of the chachamim, then they're like individuals who accept a practice, and then you could be matir it. But even if that's the case, their descendants who accept it as something authoritative have no way to be matir it. Okay. I want to jump to the end here because
he's not quite as liberal in his towards Westphalia at the end.
Yeah, so let's say, look. Hine, b'tshuvat, in the last paragraph, Vine b'tshuvat ri lebeit halevi, that's Mahari ben Lev. Simon lamachet, katav lahedya de l'isser achilat orez ein hatara. Just that there's no way to be matir the isser of achilat orez, right? There were Sephardi communities that didn't eat orez. V'ha'prichot ha'sham ba'ot tshi'i de'kvar nitva'er bitul dvarav. Right? And even though Mahari ben the Pri Chadash tries to invalidate the Mahari ben Lev, meaning he argues with the Mahari ben Lev, Ufi ani adaiti lo nitba'er velo yitba'er b'galal kein otam min hagei medinat Westphal. Right? That he hasn't given a good right. Ah, okay. V'lo yitzbayar. V'lo yitzbayar. Okay. And then his new sentence. Biglal Kane, right? As a result, meaning he disagrees with the Pri Chadash. He just dismisses the Pri Chadash. Okay, now he's, you know, now you're talking. That's what Ashkenazim do. Biglal Kane. Oige, leaders, right? He doesn't call them rabbis. He calls them leaders of Westphalia. Who matir kitnios on Pesach. Ein lehem al mashi yismochu. There's nothing for them to rely on. Ein lehem. We don't even have to address them. And even if they had the right idea, you know, for one of the reasons I wrote above, for a different reason, right? Meaning he's like what he's trying to do here, and it's actually it's going to work, right? Because the fact is today we still keep kitniot. Right, he doesn't take Westphalia on. He says maybe the rabbis in Westphalia had a good reason. Westphalia is a small province; it's a small state. So like basically, we're going to build a wall around Westphalia. Maybe the rabbis there had their own. What it was huge, yeah. You know, maybe we do have a. You know, maybe the rabbis of Westphalia did have a good reason for what they did, but we can't learn anything from them. Pirkei Dekala, meaning he's going to give his Shabbos Agadol drasha on this. Berabim she'ein l'lmod mehem, right? The inhu avdi legarme, right? They're doing this for themselves, right? There's nothing. No, we have no business with it. V'imdat, I think that's like ruma alato or something like that. Meaning he's talking to his.
Person's writing to?
Yeah. Like your honor, right? Like something ruma alato notela sotlo davar acher. If you're thinking of doing something else, mashin ogele medina tenu achar acharon ani ba v'adid tikon. If you're inclined to do something else that pertains to your province, right? If you meaning, and not just say something publicly, I'll follow you and I'll help you, right? Meaning, I'll back you up, right? He's promising him. Wow. And that was the whole, like, the questioner was like, these guys are doing terrible things. And the Chasam Sofer is like, listen, I'm not going to say anything about what the rabbis in Westphalia are doing, but we're not going to let it spread past Westphalia. Right? He says, ubifrat shlo yiyeh nogeya klal anche Westphalen. Right? I'll back you as you don't take on Westphalia itself. Right? Ki lo adon anuchi badavar zeh. Right, because I don't want to address that. I don't want to deal with that. V'achacham eina barosho, meaning use common sense here. Right?
Is that because of the fact that Rabbanan and Westphalia were you know government?
I think there's a strong case to be made for that. I think there's a strong case to be made that they were seen as somehow like that they had Napoleon's ear and Napoleon.
You understand why I'm not attacking
correct.
Them?
Correct.
Because,
correct.
Chacham eina barosho. They're very wrong, but I'm not going to tread there.
Right.
Could be.
No one to hold them, no one to fold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So this is what you were asking before, meaning his limud zchus, is his limud zchus just, meaning because he really thinks that they're doing the right thing or that they might be doing the right thing, or is his limud zchus just, like, find something so that you don't have to take these guys on straight up. I think you're probably right.
And that there wouldn't be anything in writing that could be used against him.
Yeah, again, you know, Napoleon is rampaging
right.
through Europe as
certainly
we speak.
In 1810.
You know, 1810. We all had a hard time understanding his name in Swiss. What does it do with Aniam, right? I think
right.
I think he was trying to leave holes in his name in Swiss. I don't think he was trying to
interesting.
I think he was...
It's an interesting theory.
I don't think he wanted him to say, oh, you're right.
Right.
There's an issue. The matzah's too thick.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we really need to eat kidney oats.
Mm. And the next thing he says, Vav Dalad Lamin, right? V'day l'chakima, right? Right? You know, I hope you understand what I'm saying without me having to spell it out. Right? Right? That illusion should be sufficient for a wise man. That my few words here contain a lot. Whatever. Okay? may these words, the words, your holy words again reach us, we will honor them. Right? Hakotev b'chofzi, somebody who's writing hurriedly. Hachotem ba'ahava, ba'ahava rabba, signing with abundant love. Pei Beis is Pressburg. Yom Gimel Chof Aleph Adar Rishon Taf Kuf Ayin. Moshe Hakatan Sofer, mi Frankfurt de Main.
There's something interesting in this tshuva. The tshuva is interesting globally, and it tackles an important issue of kidney oat.
Mm-hmm.
And you can understand there's the political aspects here. But in the context of our weekly thing, we've mm-hmm. seen a lot of tshuvot that start off with a question, the answer is already determined,
mm-hmm.
and the A to B, how to get the A to B is often a little bit scary. With the Rishonim, there's mm-hmm. there's much less material.
We didn't
to
get
go
into
through.
The whole argument
now,
here.
Now, we didn't get into here. And even when we're doing the note to Yehudas, where he'll have a question and he'll have an answer, and he'll do some lundus, but the lundus is often not related to the bottom line. The bottom line, he says, mm-hmm. but still it's usser, because,
right.
just because.
Or, yeah.
And if this truth, while we're talking, I was looking through different parts, he must have gone through 15 different nuances about different, what kind of minhag you're allowed to move out or whatnot, and different... And
mm-hmm.
this is actually an example of a tshuva where he's, it's very rigorous, from a scholarly Tama, he's going through all the material in every single
mm-hmm.
aspect, which we didn't get into at all. But this is like much more like a modern tshuva, like when you read a tshuva now, where they go through,
almost like a Supreme Court decision, right? You're like, you really want to...
No, tshuvas nowadays are all written like this, where they go through all the lumdas and they go through everything, and all the earlier tshuvas were not written like that. There'd be a question, there'd be a few deliberations, and then
the deliberations
might lead to, say, but still this.
Notably, Yehuda does write long tshuvas.
And he has pilpul, but sometimes the pilpul feels like it's latzis yidei chavas. It's not actually related to the answer.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's necessarily a temporal thing. Listen, when we get to the Rishonim barely quote proof texts because
there are far fewer texts to quote.
That's right. Like who's Rashi is going to quote the Rambam?
You can't quote the Rishonim. You can't.
That's right. And we saw that tshuva. Rashi's tshuva on Yisrael Af Al Pi Shechata, where he only quotes one source, and that one source is a very, very dubious Agada in Sanhedrin that's talking about Achan, right? And he's like, Yisrael Af Al Pi Shechata, and based on that, he's like, it's just an earth-shattering tshuva, like so many repercussions of that tshuva, right? That there's the idea of like, it's almost like part of our identity today. Like, once a Jew, always a Jew. There's no way you can un-be Jewish, right? That was... actually not the case. In the time of the Gaonim, there were those tshuvas that said that, if there's a zakuka liyavam, right, who had become, who had converted out of Judaism, then she doesn't need chalitza because he's not a Jewish anymore, because he's not Jewish anymore. And like, and Rashi's like, no, Yisrael afa bishachata. So it's pure rhetoric. It's not, there's no...
Of course there, the Gaonim were being makel.
Of course. Rashi's creating agunas.
Right.
Yeah. So there's definitely, but amongst achronim, especially once you get into like later achronim, you have such a variety of styles. Look, Moshe Feinstein and Rav Ovadia Yosef, they were the same generation, more or less. Maybe Rav Ovadia was a little bit younger. A generation younger. But,
is there a book about that, or Moshe's from Mars and Ovadia's from Venus?
I haven't seen it. But
those two.
But Moshe's writing
Mars.
Really, really short tshuvas.
And they weren't they were based on primary sources pretty much only.
No. there were a lot of, you know, there were a lot of things that he quoted, but, you know, an interesting study would be, who does Rav Moshe feel like he has to quote? Because there aren't, I mean, first of all, like, you know, in his famous tshuva on Chol of Yisrael, he quotes the Pri Chadash only to bash him, because, hey, like I said, Pri Chadash, Ashkenazi whipping boy. Yeah, exactly. And I think that he's doing that in order to, like, prove his Ashkenazi credentials. The Pri Chadash had a heter for Chol of Yisrael. Rav Moshe rejects Pri Chadash's heter for Chol of Yisrael and then comes up with his own, right? Which is, it's I need to show my Ashkenazi, I need to show my bona fides first. How do I show my bona fides? I'm gonna pile onto the Pri Chadash, right? Then I can come up with my, I can give 2-3 shiurim on that one tshuva, because it's just such a, it's so brilliant what he does in that tshuva. It's just so amazingly brilliant what he does in that tshuva on milk.
How do you characterize the Chazon Ish's methodology, since his conclusion is always about the same?
I don't know. I don't know, but that's also not true. And a lot of things about mitzvos hatzlius ba'aretz, he's very makel. Yeah. Irvin, he has some pretty wild kulas. Like, he was definitely, you know, like, that's a strain that you almost have in, that you have in Lithuania, just in, like, very, very independent, like, almost not worried about precedent. Chasam Sofer, in some ways, is the opposite. Chasam Sofer is very concerned with precedent. You know, the Vilna Gaon was not so much concerned with precedent. The Noda B'Yehuda is an interesting study, because he was and he wasn't concerned with precedent. He was trying to, put it this way, he was much more concerned with Talmudic precedent, and he was trying to retain, you know, he was trying to establish, I mean, he was getting rid of a lot of things that were established custom that were based on, you know, Kabbalah and things like that. He was not a fan. Yeah, I mean, each one of these poskim, it's like olam umlo'o. It's, you know, like so much that it discovered and relearned and understood, you know, within particular contexts. I mean, we tend to look at everything horizontally, that all of these, you know, that all of these poskim are in, you know, this grand conversation with one another, sitting in the same base medrash. And to a certain degree, they are. But to a certain degree, each one is also, you know, I wouldn't say a product of their time in the sense that they couldn't help but be a product of their time, but they're shaped by the events of their time, whether it's, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, whether it's the invention of the printing press, the rise of empiricism, the fact that there are heresies going on, whether it's reform or Sabbatianism or Frankism or whatever. You want to write that down, Aryeh?
Would you say that Rav Avadya Yosef sort of does treat them as if they're all in the same room?
No, he treats them as though they're all in the same room. Meaning once they're printed,
right?
Once they're out there, once they become canon, right? They are all in the same room, right? They are all participating in this conversation with one another, and it doesn't matter what the particular circumstances were that led the Noda B'Yehuda to Paskin that it's preferable to shave on Chol HaMoed and under certain circumstances. It became part of the discourse, right? And so that's something that, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein can pick up on however many, you know, 200 years later when he writes about what he writes about the subject, right? So meaning I do think that everything has to be looked at both, you know, horizontally and vertically, right? Horizontally in terms of, you know, how it's interacting with, you know, the events that shape it, and vertically that each one is contending with precedent and contending with a halachic tradition and becomes part of a halachic tradition that's going to be quoted by future generations. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chasam Sofer and the Noda B'Yehuda, the Chasam Sofer's tshuva on umbrellas, right? And he's dealing, like, he wrote the tshuva just a couple of years after the Noda B'Yehuda Madura B'Tinyana was printed. And the Noda B'Yehuda Madura B'Tinyana says that opening an umbrella on Shabbos is a cheshash iser de oraisa of boneh on Shabbos, right? But in Pressburg, people were walking around with, you know, parasols. And Chasam Sofer, he has to dance around the Noda B'Yehuda because the Noda B'Yehuda was the guggle of the previous generation. So on one end, he has to deal with it. But at the same time, that's what they are doing, you know. So there's always this dynamic. All right. Shavua Tov. I think next week we'll have 2 weeks, I think, you know, Motzai Shabbos HaGadol, I think we're going to be done. I don't wait for Shabbos anyway. I just don't think there's going to be a shir. But next week, I think we'll do Rav Shlomo Kluger on machine matzahs. In the 1850s or 60s, like the first shuvah was on machine matzahs. Could be fun.
Which way is it going to go?